All right, we'll pick it up on session 28, page 199 of your workbook. Now let's take a quick review, a few thoughts about where we were previously. Last week we looked at the end of the Six-Day War with the conclusion of the war in the Northern Front against Syria. And Israel, of course, concluded the Six-Day War by taking the Golan Heights. And, of course, this was a map of that area. Lebanon to the north, Israel to the west, Syria to the east, and Jordan to the south there. And the Golan Heights surrounded by these four countries. So the new geographical, military, economic entity was created after June 10, 1967, with Israel occupying the Sinai Peninsula in its entirety, the Gaza Strip, the Straits of Tehran are open, occupying the West Bank and the Golan Heights. So we have a brand new Israel in 1967 for a few years. Then we finished up by looking at Program 7 of Against All Odds, entitled 1967, where we saw some of the very unusual events that individual soldiers experienced during the 67 war. And that showed us God was active in the nation, with the nation, preserving her. So now let's pick it up on page 199. And the top of page 199 is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The PFLP is founded. So we're going to read just the first paragraph. The PFLP was founded by George Habash in December of 1967 in the wake of the Six-Day War. Although throughout most of its existence, the organization combined Marxist ideology with Palestinian nationalism and was among the first of the Palestinian organizations to use terrorism as a means to win attention to its cause. The PFLP saw the elimination of Israel as a means towards the ultimate goal of ridding the Middle East of dictators who kowtowed to Western capitalism. Notice, it isn't ridding the Middle East of dictators. It's really ridding the Middle East of dictators who are capitalists. I mean, in the Middle East, the dictator is the way you go. That's the way. Okay, here is the logo for the Popular Front of the Liberation of Palestine. You have a stylistic Israel on the left-hand side of the logo, and of course, an invasion, an arrow going into its heart there. So you can read all about the PFLP on that page, 199. So let's move on to page 200. Ah, yes, 1968. Our good buddy Yasser Arafat. Here is his picture. You have his portrait on page 200 there. Yasser Arafat becomes the head of the PLO. He will become a major player in Israel's history until his death in 2004. Major player just entered the stage. Now you can read all about his history and his very eventful life on page 201, and so let's move on now to 202. You can read all about Yasser tonight as you go to bed. Bedtime reading here. He'll give you nightmares, right? Yes, and read about Yasser and have nightmares for the rest of the evening. So let's move on to page 202 and the War of Attrition at the top of page 202. So troubles began to brew for Nasser following the defeat of the Six-Day War. Domestic unrest began to surface in October of 1968 when riots erupted. As Nasser saw it, vindication by war was the one sure method of strengthening his hand within his own country. In fact, his hand was already being strengthened by the Russians, who viewed Israel's pulverizing victory in the Six-Day War as an intolerable challenge to their leadership in the Middle East. They wanted influence. So from the moment the ceasefire came into effect, the Soviets proceeded to reinstate large-scale arms deliveries to the Middle East. Within 2 weeks, you guys, 14 days, 2 weeks, over 200 crated MiG fighters were airlifted to Egypt and to Syria. Throughout the rest of the summer and autumn, between 2 and 3 ships a week docked at Alexandria Harbor, that's Alexandria, Egypt, carrying replacement weapons. 15 months after the war. That's a year and 3 months, you guys. Just a year and 3 months. Egypt's tank strength had been increased from 250 to 470. And their air force had received 400 new planes. So they have more arms than ever now. Just a year later, a little over a year later. So a pattern of violence along the Suez Canal accordingly developed in erratic sequences. The initial phase, from the end of the war until April 1968, was characterized by sporadic outbursts that grew in intensity and frequency as the Egyptians recovered from the 1967 disaster. Each Egyptian probe from the west bank of the canal evoked a tough counterblow from the Israelis. So the canal offered each side a first-rate defensive barrier. By autumn of 1968, a military standoff had developed. October 1968 marked a turning point in the rising crescendo of Suez fighting. On a single Saturday afternoon, a massive Egyptian artillery barrage killed 15 Israelis and demonstrated that Egypt had accumulated a vast superiority of men and equipment on the west bank of the canal. From then until late summer of 1969, the intensity of Egyptian shelling steadily mounted. The revived hostilities swiftly developed into an overt Egyptian war of attrition. See, Nasser's goal was to prevent the transformation of the canal into a de facto border, and to accomplish this by inflicting such heavy casualties that the Israelis would be forced back into Sinai or compelled to accept a political solution on Arab terms. See, a war of attrition. Just hit them hard enough and long enough, cause enough damage that they'll finally give in. That was the idea. So here is a photograph of Nasser. His back is to us. He's looking across the canal through the binoculars, and three of his generals are standing behind him. So just checking out the situation, looking at the Israeli side of the canal as they bombed the Israeli troops over there, shelled the Israeli troops. The lethal Egyptian bombardment of October 1968 dictated a modified defensive approach. To that end, the Israelis began digging into hardened concrete and steel-reinforced bunkers and fortified positions. These were known subsequently as the Bar-Lev Line, after Israel's Chief of Staff, General Chaim Bar-Lev. With the completion of the fortifications in March 1969, the Israeli General Staff expected to be able to withstand the developing war of attrition. Page 203. Now, to reverse the heavy casualty trends, Israel, by late July 1969, launched a sustained air bombardment of Egyptian guns on the west bank of the canal. For the next 3 months, Israeli planes battered away at the enemy emplacements. Gradually, Egyptian positions along the waterway were silenced. Israeli losses dropped markedly. However, January 22, 1970, Nasser pays an urgent visit to Moscow. He informed the Soviet leadership that the Israelis, in an effort to relieve pressure on the Bar-Lev line, were now bombing Egyptian artillery emplacements west of the canal and targets deep within the Nile Valley. A consequence of this far-reaching aerial activity was the evacuation of some 500,000 Egyptian citizens from the canal zone and the exposure of the Egyptian interior to Israeli incursions that were both militarily damaging and politically humiliating. A third of the Egyptian fighter force already had been shot down by the enemy planes. Nasser admitted that. And the morale of his troops had virtually collapsed. So, what did the Soviets do? The Soviets agreed to participate more actively in defending Egyptian military and civilian targets, and they sure did, you guys. By mid-February, the Soviet airlift to Egypt had increased four times above the ordinary high level. Within 6 months, the Russians had between 10,000 and 14,000 of their own instructors and advisors in Egypt. as well as an impressive naval flotilla of 60 vessels off the Egyptian coast, an armada that matched the U.S. 6th Fleet in tonnage and surface firepower. Additionally, Soviet pilots were flying reconnaissance missions from Egyptian bases. Others were on interception alert at Egyptian fields, while Soviet units manned SAM-3 anti-aircraft missile sites. And here's an example of the Soviet-Egyptian S-125, or the SAM-3, surface-to-air missile version number 3. Pretty potent anti-aircraft defense system. Something you didn't want to mess with if you're a pilot. So Russians were giving them to the Egyptians. For Israel, the most crucial development was intelligence information that Soviet pilots were assuming responsibility for air defense over the Nile Valley. Accordingly, in April 1979, the Israelis suspended their deep penetration raids. Excuse me, April 1979. Oh, I've got 1979 here. Okay, must be my mistake.
Skip 9 years.
And I skipped, jumped. Okay, 1970. Okay, I got that corrected. Yes, right. The Egyptians, in turn, began moving new SAM missile batteries toward the canal. At the end of June 1970, Soviet aviators were flying combat patrols on both the northern and southern outlets of the canal. The Egyptian-Soviet defense system was further thickened with the introduction of SAM-4 and SAM-6 missiles. Before the new rockets were detected on June 30th, they managed to shoot down two Israeli Phantom jets. And here is the McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom 2, which was the key aircraft in the Israeli arsenal, supplied again by...
The lead sled.
The lead sled, people called it. Well, I wasn't a pilot. I saw them...
Anything will fly.
They flew. I saw them fly in Vietnam, and they flew, that's for sure. So, in fact, I would look at one, and I'd say, boy, if you could just strip all that armament off it, you could go to the moon. Turn on the afterburner and go to the moon.
Just about.
Just about, yep. Yeah, they were amazing aircraft. But two of them were down. In early July, they brought down an additional 5 Phantoms over the west bank of the canal. So as the Israelis encountered these Soviet ripple fire tactics and a seemingly inexhaustible supply of enemy missile batteries, they recognized that they were facing their gravest military crisis since the week immediately preceding the 1967 war. At the end of July, Israel had suffered more than 3,000 casualties since the 1967 war. But there's another side of the picture. The Egyptians had taken a fearful battering of their own. Since April 1970 alone, they had lost over 10,000 casualties to Israeli air and artillery action. Page 204. Big change on page 204. Nasser dies of a heart attack. September 1970. The accession of Anwar al-Sadat allowed Jerusalem for the first time to anticipate a new and possibly more moderate stance. May 27, 1971. Came the revelation of a new and wide-ranging treaty between Egypt and the Soviet Union. Early in 1972, agreement was reached between the U.S. and Israel on a continued supply to Israel of American Phantom jets and other sophisticated electronic equipment. By the spring of that year, the Israeli Air Force evidently had assured itself of superiority, not only over its Egyptian counterpart, but over the Egyptian-Soviet defense network. And that fact registered with Cairo. This accounted for the mounting frustration in the Egyptian government and eventually for the crisis in relations between Sadat and the Kremlin leadership. Moscow's goal was a permanent military base in Egypt to be used for its own strategic and regional purposes. See, they wanted influence in the Middle East. That's what their aim was. The Kremlin was not interested in direct military involvement with the conflict with Israel. They did not want their own Middle East Vietnam. Sadat was angered. He retaliated with an ultimatum on July 13, 1972, telling the Soviets to withdraw their advisors and instructors. To the astonishment of both Washington and Israel, the Russians evacuated the largest part of their personnel from Egypt, and the war of attrition collapsed. All right, page 205, you have this map, which is kind of a summary of the War of Attrition, 1969 to 1970. And I've put a red box around these explanatory boxes on your map, so you can read those boxes and get a quick summary of the War of Attrition and see geographically how it played out on the map. All righty. Next page. Page 206. Golda Meir. Golda becomes prime minister. And, of course, you have this portrait of Golda on page 206 there. She looks like a... she looks very grandmotherly there, doesn't she? She doesn't look like the prime minister of a country, does she? All right, there's Golda. Just as David Ben-Gurion is the man most associated with the Yishuv, near the settlements, so Golda Meir is probably the woman most associated with the modern state of Israel. She was born Golda Mabovich in 1898 in Kiev, Russia. And it's now called the Ukraine. You know, was Kiev, Russia, now it's the Ukraine, Kiev, the Ukraine.
Well, it might be Russia again.
It might be Russia again, yeah. Who knows how it's going to go. Now, here's a map of the Ukraine. And there's Kiev. That's where Golda was born. Interestingly enough, my family also came from Kiev in the Ukraine. Aaron Cooperman, my great-great, I don't know how many greats I should put in there, my great-great, at least, grandfather was a bookkeeper in a flour mill in Kiev. He was also a scribe, and there's some indications, although we can't prove it, that he was a Levite. So that side of the family, that part of the family came from Kiev, and to the south and a little bit to the west is the little town of Buki. You probably have never heard of that town in the Ukraine. And that's where Meir Zolotushka and his family lived. Meir Zolotushka, again, a great-great-great-grandfather of mine, was a horse trader in the little town of Buki. So just as Golda's family immigrated to the United States in 1906, and took up residence in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so my family immigrated to the United States and took up residence in New York City. And of course, the question you need to ask is, why did these families, the Zolotushka family, the Cooperman family, the Mabovich family, why did this family and many other families immigrate to the United States or, you know, in different area or to Israel? Well, probably this is a result of the Kishinev pogrom in 1903. Remember the Kishinev pogrom we were talking about? Because the second Aliyah began in 1904. And this is probably the remnants of the second Aliyah, although these folks are not going to Israel. So this is probably the reason why all these families were leaving the Ukraine. Pogroms. All right, you guys can read all about Golda's life on page 206. So feel free to read that after you read about Yasser Arafat, and she'll take away your nightmares, okay? So you can read all about Golda on page 206. So let's move to page 207 and 1973 and the Yom Kippur War. Now here's a book that I would encourage you to read if you're a big reader. It's called The Eve of Destruction by Howard Bloom. It's available on Amazon.com. The Untold Story of the Yom Kippur War. I found it fascinating reading, so I think you would too. So I see some pencils are flying, so I'll give you a second to write down The Eve of Destruction by Howard Bloom. The description on the front. On October 6, 1973, Arab armies launched a daring surprise attack that nearly destroyed Israel and changed the Middle East forever. Fascinating book. All right, everybody all set there? Everybody that wants it got a copy down? All righty. All right, the heading in bold words, complacency. Let's explain that. These bold-faced and self-congratulatory placards greeted the Israeli public as the election for Israel's 8th Knesset drew near. You have the quote before you. There is peace on the banks of the canal. And in the Sinai Desert, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, and on the Golan. These lines are safe. The bridges are open. Jerusalem is united. New settlements have been established, and our political position is stable. This is the result of a balanced, bold, and far-sighted policy. You know that only the labor alignment could have accomplished this. These bits of political propaganda expressed a quite genuine mood of national security and prosperity. In autumn of 1973, Israel's economy sustained its upward momentum. The GNP, the gross national product, continued to grow at an annual rate of 10%. And employment opportunities were so widespread that even 130,000 Arab workers commuting from the administered territories did not take up the slack. It was a time of prosperity for the West Bank, too. The Arabs were prospering quite a bit. Evidence of the boom was everywhere to be seen. High-rise apartment buildings, luxurious new villas, a forest of television antennas, crowded shops, roads and highways choked with fully 370,000 private vehicles and a population of less than 3 million. And all this in addition to unprecedented security at home. Little wonder that the electoral campaign was taking place in an atmosphere so devoid of survivalist urgency as to border on complacency. In early September 1973, a new political party came into being. It was the right-center bloc entitled Likud, Unity, and dominated by Menachem Begin. On the military scene, self-assurance reflected and influenced Israel's military posture. Laxity began to taint all facets of the defense structure. The premier example was the Bar-Lev line. The Bar-Lev line had never been conceived as a barrier against full-scale invasion from Egypt. Its initial purpose was to serve merely as a tripwire, you know, as a warning, a tripwire that would activate reinforcements from bases and roads deeper in the Sinai. At tremendous expense, some 30 major strongholds had been built along the canal at irregularly spaced intervals. And here is just a photo of a portion, a very tiny portion of the Bar-Lev line. You've got trenches, you've got all kinds of fortified bunkers all along the Suez Canal, overlooking the canal. Tremendously expensive. Now, the establishment of the Bar-Lev fortifications was sharply criticized by several respected army commanders. They said that the Bar-Lev line would create in the army and in Israel at large a fixed defense philosophy. This approach was alien to the nation's tradition of mobility and retaliatory attack. Never had such elaborate fortifications been constructed, even to protect Israel itself. Here, these are on the Sinai, page 208. So the dividing line between conceiving of the Bar-Lev line as an early warning outpost and as an early defense line gradually became blurred. It was this subsequent lack of clarity with its mixture of fixed defense and tripwire concepts that was to exact its toll in the first hours of October 6, 1973. Israeli self-assurance plainly was not weakened by the death of Nasser in September of 1970, or even less by the choice of Vice President Anwar Sadat as his successor. And of course, you have this portrait of Sadat on page 208. You know, and Sadat also did his share of reinforcing complacency. Sadat's relaxed approach, his lack of interest in pan-Arabist adventures, and his involvement in essentially domestic concerns seemingly gave hope for peace in the Middle East. Yet for all his gracious demeanor and generosity, the new president was laying the groundwork for a confrontation with Israel from the very onset of his presidency. For one thing, Egypt's economic needs, its population explosion, dictated the vital importance of opening the Suez Canal and rebuilding canal cities. You know, the war of attrition had closed the waterway. You're not going to send boats through a canal with mortars and rockets flying over your head. Thus, as early as October 1971, Sadat instructed his military command to prepare for crossing the canal. The president warned his countrymen the following May of 1972 that a showdown with Israel was inevitable and that he was prepared to, quote, sacrifice 1 million men in the forthcoming war. Well, if I was a private in his army, I'd say, thanks a lot, Sadat. You know. Few in Israel gave heed to Sadat's warnings, particularly after July 1972, when he ordered the removal of the Soviet advisors from Egypt. Sadat then embarked on building a common strategy within the Arab camp. He had little difficulty with President Hafez al-Assad of Syria. Now, it was the expulsion of Soviet advisors from Egypt in July of 1972 that in the end strengthened Assad's hand. As a rebuke to Sadat, to Egypt, and in an effort to consolidate their position in the Middle East, the Soviets decided to ship unprecedented quantities of military equipment to Syria. All right, Egypt, you don't like us? Well, Syria will like us. This included 300 new tanks, 300 MiG-21 fighter planes, and hundreds of late-model SAM-6 missiles. Indeed, Syria now became the most heavily armed nation per capita in the Arab world. Extensive plans were laid for a two-pronged attack under Egyptian strategic command. Sadat himself visited Damascus in May and June to confirm these arrangements. Sadat won over Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and he mended fences with Hussein of Jordan. He even won assurance of Soviet military backing. Throughout the summer of 1973, the Soviets accelerated their arms shipments to Syria, and in the early fall embarked upon a massive new delivery program to Egypt. The shipments included substantial quantities of the latest anti-aircraft missiles, ranging from the highly mobile SAM-6s to shoulder-carried SAM-7s, as well as limited numbers of Scud and Frog ground-to-ground missiles for attack against Israel's population centers. Plans were made for an airtime warlift, or wartime airlift. There we go. Either one sounds right, a warlift, an airtime warlift. That works too. In the week before October 6th, the Soviets launched 5 new Cosmos satellites into orbit to photograph Israeli defenses in the north and the south. By then, too, a Soviet electronics intelligence ship was sailing toward Egypt, and the families of Soviet advisors in Egypt and Syria were being hastily evacuated. October 6th was decided upon as the most advantageous date. The Israelis would be preoccupied with their election campaigns. They would be worshiping and fasting on their holy day of Yom Kippur, and they would hardly expect an attack during the Muslim festival of Ramadan. Everything depended on simultaneous initiative and surprise. Now, the Israelis were by no means oblivious to the scope of these maneuvers, nor to the fact that large quantities of men and equipment were being accumulated along the waterway. Neither did it escape them that in the north, the Syrians were methodically augmenting their tank and artillery forces, and they had triple lines of defense that had been constructed across the Golan Plain to the outskirts of Damascus. For the time being, the Israeli general staff persuaded itself that these maneuvers and reinforcements were essentially defensive. In the south, they were interpreted as yet another gambit in Sadat's annual war of nerves. Sadat and his advisors did much to foster this illusion. For one thing, the Egyptian president had been announcing the moment of decision with such frequency during the past 2 years that it was difficult to take seriously any of his latest warnings. Now, in the last months of October, Sadat intensified his deception. He allowed reports to be circulated of growing tensions between Egypt and the Soviet Union, of Soviet unwillingness to provide Egypt with new weaponry following the July 1972 expulsion of Russian advisors. Israel believed these reports. On October 3rd, Prime Minister Golda Meir held a cabinet meeting with her defense and military commanders, Moshe Dayan, Yigdal Alon, Israel Galili, and others. The group agreed unanimously that war was not imminent. In fact, Israeli intelligence had all the necessary data of Arab preparations and deployments. The failure was in evaluation. Israel was relying heavily on military electronic data provided by technicians. Modern electronic equipment could not replace scholarly analytical appraisals of the Arab mentality. The intelligence chiefs had made up their minds that Sadat and Assad would surely understand, as Israel understood, that a far-reaching offensive operation was unthinkable without dominant air power, and the Arabs were unlikely to have an effective bomber force for several years. Page 210. This was the conception that inhibited a broader and more imaginative understanding of Arab frustration and vindictiveness. Reaction to the Arab concentration of forces came belatedly, indeed, not until October 5th, the eve of Yom Kippur. It was then only, faced with overwhelming evidence of a large-scale Arab preparations, that the General Staff agreed to declare an alert. At 4 a.m. the next day, Israeli and American monitors had intercepted the unmistakable radio signals of a final Arab war preparations. Immediately, Diane and General Elazar, the Chief of Staff, were notified and informed that 0 hour evidently would come in 14 short hours. At 5 a.m., the General Staff commanders were meeting at the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. Elazar requested full immediate mobilization and a preemptive airstrike. Diane turned him down, although he consented finally to recommend the mobilization of the Armored Corps Reserve. 100,000 Armored Corps personnel began assembling. Fortunately, on Yom Kippur, it was possible to contact the largest numbers of reservists at their homes or in the synagogues, and the roads were clear of traffic. Even then, more than 24 hours would pass before all the men reached their units. The men on the Bar-Lev line, that's the Suez Canal, were ordered to withdraw to their fortifications and to keep alert. They did so in a leisurely fashion, refusing to take seriously the notion of a major attack. Many of the troops were inexperienced young reservists. Large numbers of trained regulars had been given leave for the Yom Kippur holiday, another lethal blunder. From his headquarters in Nazareth, General Yitzhak Hofi, the Northern Front commander, issued orders for an alert. He was denied authority to move his standing tank brigade forward, lest the Syrians regarded it as a provocation. Again, the alert was observed laxly, reflecting the erosion of military discipline since 1967. At 2 p.m., the Israeli cabinet gathered in an emergency session, and a military aide suddenly entered the conference room and whispered urgently to Mrs. Meir, "The enemy onslaught had begun." And it is now 10 minutes to 8, so I'm going to give you guys your break. Yes, question?
This is 1972.
This is 1973.
Three.
Yeah, 1973. Do I have 72 written down somewhere?
No.
Okay. All right, the Northern War with Syria is where we'll pick it up after your break. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar. All right, let's pick it up then on the bottom of page 210, the Northern War with Syria. So our last sentence was, the enemy onslaught had begun, and it began with a vengeance. Thousands of shells and bombs exploded along the eastern bank of the canal and along the entire ceasefire line of the Golan Heights. Enemy planes roared overhead, strafing deep behind Israel's forward positions. Israel quickly lost her radar surveillance fortification. Excuse me. Yes, 6,000 feet atop Mount Hermon. It was an earthquake of an assault in the Golan. After a 55-minute artillery barrage, two Syrian armored divisions of 800 tanks and three infantry divisions in personnel carriers began rumbling across the ceasefire line. Page 211. The hopelessly outnumbered Israeli defenders fought as if berserk, inflicting heavy losses but only delaying the steady advance. The Israelis were eventually reduced to six tanks. One, two, three, four, five, six. That's it. The evening of October 8th, the Syrians unleashed another devastating artillery barrage, and a new force of 600 heavy tanks emerged from the smoke, followed by an even larger waves of armored personnel carriers. The shadow of a new Holocaust descended over Israel. However, it developed that the Syrians in this last effort had expended everything. They were out of supplies. They needed to be equipped, re-equipped badly. As Israeli reinforcements slowly began to crawl up the Golan, they began to maul the Syrian supply convoys with pinpoint gunnery. The supply convoys suddenly began turning in their tracks and running. That left the frontline troops without firepower, and they began to flee as well. So the bludgeoned Israeli defenders shook off their exhaustion, managed to round up 20 tanks, and made mincemeat out of the Syrian armor and personnel carriers as they pursued them. A handful of dazed and flogged youngsters in a scattering of battered tanks had lifted the shadow of certain catastrophe from the nation. On the 10th, the Israeli counterattack began. By the early afternoon, precisely 4 days after the Syrians had launched their avalanche against Israel, not one of their tanks remained in fighting condition in Israeli territory. Strewn along the route of Israeli advance were 837 destroyed enemy tanks, over 3,000 personnel carriers, hundreds of anti-tank guns, and vast piles of military equipment. And when I read that paragraph, I think of Ezekiel chapter 39, verses 1 through 5 and 8 through 10. I think of an upcoming battle in which there will be vast piles of military equipment left over. Here is Ezekiel 39, starting with verses 1 through 5. Of course, this is in the future. This will occur in the future. "And you, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and I will turn you around and drive you on and take you up from the remotest parts of the north and bring you against the mountains of Israel. I will strike your bow from your left hand and dash down your arrows from your right hand. You will fall on the mountains of Israel, you and all your troops and the peoples who are with you. I will give you as food to every kind of predatory bird and beast of the field. You will fall in the open field, for it is I who have spoken, declares the Lord God." Now just jump down to verse 8. "Behold, it is coming, it shall be done, declares the Lord God. That is the day of which I have spoken. Then those who inhabit the cities of Israel will go out and make fires with the weapons and burn them, both shields and bucklers, bows and arrows, war, clubs and spears. For 7 years they will make fires with them." In other words, vast, vast piles of military equipment will be left at the conclusion of the war of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 39. "They will not take wood from the field or gather firewood from the forest, for they will make fires with the weapons, and they will take the spoil of those who despoiled them and seize the plunder of those who plundered them, declares the Lord God." So while there were vast piles of military equipment after the Syrians were defeated, there will be even greater piles of military equipment when the Russian coalition is defeated in the future. But that lies in the future of Israel. And perhaps we'll get to look at that at the end of this class. We'll see. All right, the Syrians had thrown all they had into the offensive with every advantage of numbers, surprise, and equipment. And now the pride of their army lay smoking and ruined on the Golan. Full, if belated, mobilization had its effect on the northern front. By October 9th and 10th, Israel had forced the Syrians back to the initial ceasefire lines. Nevertheless, it was recognized that the Syrian army could not be allowed to recover and absorb equipment pouring in from the Soviet Union. On the evening of the 10th, the general staff agreed that it was necessary to penetrate at least 12 miles beyond the ceasefire line. Only then could the Syrians be neutralized as a factor in the war. The 7th Armored Brigade was given the honors, and in less than 24 hours, the Syrians showed signs of weakening. By October 18th, Israel commanded the flat terrain extending to the outskirts of Damascus, only 22 miles away. Now, here's a couple of maps of the situation, so we'll get a geographic fix on it all. Here we see Israel on October 1st, 1973, and you see the location of Damascus, just a short distance from the Golan Heights. This is the area we're talking about, the Golan Heights and the city of Damascus. And here is a map of the Syrian invasion. This is the initial Syrian earthquake across the DMZ into the Golan Heights, followed by the Israeli response, belated, but it pushed the Syrians right back to the DMZ, right back to the initial border. And then the Israelis kept hammering on the Syrians and broke through the Syrian lines and pushed them all the way back to within 22 miles of Damascus. So that was the northern war. So the suburbs of the city, Damascus, lay within artillery range. And this is a good place to consolidate forces. Although Arab counterattacks were mounted each day thereafter against the Israeli wedge, the Jews launched no further offensive action against the Syrian capital. On the night of October 20th, orders were transmitted to recapture the heights of Mount Hermon. This was accomplished by the dawn of October 22nd. So the radar eyes of Israel had been restored. Now here is a picture of Mount Hermon I took on one of my tours of Israel. I'm standing, those of you who have been with me to Israel, you know from this location that the Druze Falafel restaurant is right behind me. Okay. You remember the Druze Falafel restaurant? What a good place. You have to go there if you go to Israel. Such a falafel. But anyway, I'm looking at Mount Hermon, and it's November, and it's been a warm summer and a mild fall so far, so there's no snow on Mount Hermon. Now, I know you can't see it from your location, but there is the radar station that Israel finds so valuable to look into Syria. So, in order for you to see it, I cranked up my telephoto as far as it would go, and here is a close-up. And there on the top of the hill, you can see, on the top of Mount Hermon, you can see the Israeli military stations with their radar eyes looking into Syria, looking into the Golan Plateau, looking at Damascus, looking, always looking. Because you never know what Syria is going to pull next. So there it is. They probably were looking at me, too, taking that picture. What's that guy doing down there taking a picture of me? All right, page 212. Did I hear a question? No. All right, page 212, the Southern War with Egypt. So here's our map. And we've been up here in the Northern War with the Golan Heights and Damascus. Now we're going to move down to the Southern War, the Suez Canal, and the nation of Egypt. So that's where we are geographically. 230 miles to the southwest, during the same grim hours of October 6 and 7, the Israelis were tasting the power of one of the largest standing armies in the world. Positioned along the canal were five Egyptian infantry divisions, three mixed infantry and tank divisions, 22 independent infantry, commando, and paratroop brigades. With the Air Force, the enemy constituted not less than 600,000 men, 2,000 tanks, 2,300 artillery pieces, 160 SAM missile batteries, these are just batteries, with at least four missiles per battery, and 550 combat planes. Facing this war machine in the Sinai, along the 110 miles of the canal, were precisely 436 Israeli soldiers. They were in a series of bunkers, 7 to 10 miles apart, together with three tanks and seven artillery batteries. It's kind of a lopsided battle here, isn't it? Yes.
And God.
Yes, yes. We never forget the Lord. At 2 p.m. on October 6th, as Sadat's planes attacked the air bases and the radar stations behind Israeli lines, the full weight of Egyptian artillery opened up along the entire front, including volleys of long-range Frog missiles. For the next 53 minutes, the skeletal Israeli contingents on the East Bank fortifications endured murderous shelling. When the barrage reached its crescendo, the first wave of 8,000 Egyptian infantry moved across the waterway on fiberglass boats. There was little that the shell-shocked Israeli reservists in the fortifications could do to halt the crossings. By nightfall, no fewer than 30,000 Egyptian infantrymen had attained a foothold throughout the eastern length of the canal. Some units had pushed forward to a depth of 3 miles. That night, 11 pontoon bridges went up across the water and the tanks began moving over. Within 24 hours of the initial offensive, 5 Egyptian artillery and armored divisions had taken up positions 3 miles east of the canal, entirely outflanking the Barlev line, which they anticipated taking at their convenience. So here is a map of the Egyptian advance on October 6th. You can see Egypt on the left side, the brown area, and the Israeli territory on the right side, and the tanks and infantry had gone 3 miles deep into the Sinai. Totally overrun the Barlev line. So it was a remarkable achievement. General Shazly, that's the Egyptian general, had expected his army to suffer as many as 10,000 casualties. Instead, Egyptian dead in the first stage totaled 180. As the Israelis withdrew, the Egyptians turned their attention to the remnants of the Barlev fortifications. 5 had been overrun at the outset. 6 had been evacuated. Only 9 bunkers continued to hold out. At headquarters, this is Israeli headquarters, staff officers wept, aware that all rescue efforts would now be futile. Defenders were given permission to surrender. All but one of them did. The position at Port Fouad held out until the end of the war. Early in October 9th, the Israeli counterattack on the southern sector had begun. Israeli forces were resuming their traditional coordination and flair. However, this initial attempt to destroy the Egyptian foothold failed with heavy losses. Page 213. Top of page 213. There we go. Thus, on October 10th, the battle lines stabilized with Israel holding its own on the Golan, the Egyptians temporarily digging in to the east of the Suez Canal. At this time, 70,000 enemy troops had crossed the waterway and had established an unbroken line now 6 miles in depth. By October 14th, the Israelis had reinforced their strength with 430 tanks. At dawn on the 14th, preceded by a 90-minute artillery bombardment, the Egyptians launched their full strength eastward. You might have it, does your book say westward? It would be eastward. My mistake there, my typo. Eastward. The Israelis saw a huge cloud of dust moving toward them. The battle lasted half a day. It was a slaughter. Over 250 Egyptian tanks were destroyed within the first 2 hours of combat. When the Egyptians attempted to bring infantry forward with their armor, hundreds of personnel carriers were similarly liquidated. The expert Israeli tankers then cut off the retreat of the Egyptian stragglers, knocking out another 55 tanks without a single loss of their own. The firing died down at 3 p.m. Israel had won an armored victory that exceeded Montgomery's triumph over Rommel in World War II. Isn't that amazing? In addition, a seam had opened up between the Egyptian 2nd Army in the north and the 3rd Army in the south. By coincidence, this seam coincided with a staging area that Ariel Sharon had prepared years earlier. Imagine that. The little details God throws in here. The staging area had been developed in 1968 as part of the Israeli preparations of a counterattack across the canal if it was needed. So a crossing was authorized. It was dubbed Operation Gazelle. Ariel Sharon would take a brigade across. Well, the crossing went poorly. By 9 a.m. on October 15th, a mere 30 tanks and 2,000 men had reached the west bank of the canal. However, the Egyptian command, when informed of the small numbers, assumed that a small Israeli raiding party was running loose. They didn't bother to react. So in God's providence, you guys, even a botched, poorly executed military maneuver worked out to Israel's advantage. Okay? You know, God makes all things turn around for good, doesn't he? On October 17th, Israeli tanks had fought their way to the crossing point. Pontoon bridges were erected, and the Israeli tanks began to rumble en masse into Egypt. Only then did Cairo wake up to the fact that Sharon's initial small crossing was far more than a raid. Israeli armor began systematically destroying Egyptian missile batteries and tearing holes in the Egyptian air defenses. The divisions ground ahead at full tilt through the Egyptian Third Army's West Bank supply lines. On the morning of October 22nd, the UN approved a Soviet and American appeal for a ceasefire to go into effect in 12 hours. Israel accepted the ceasefire on the same day as did Jordan and Egypt. The ceasefire deadline found the Egyptian Third Army hopelessly trapped with its supply lines cut and large numbers of troops fleeing in disorder. 8,000 were already prisoners. Under these circumstances, the Egyptians ignored the ceasefire and struck repeatedly at the Israelis in an effort to open up an exit corridor. A new ceasefire was proposed on October 24th. It was accepted, and Israel fought up to the last moment. When the fighting stopped, three divisions had penetrated 25 miles into Egypt, dominating the southern half of the West Bank. On the East Bank, Egyptian forces were deployed along the Barlev line to a depth of 3 to 5 miles. Now, here's some maps of Operation Gazelle. You don't have them in your notebook, but exactly how the SEAM facilitated the Israeli victory. First of all, we have Ariel Sharon, and his brigade was to exploit the seam between the northern Egyptian army and the southern Egyptian army and cross the canal. That would be followed by General Adon and his brigade. They would fight their way south and then work through the seam. General Magan would fight his way north and take his tanks through the seam as well. So that's exactly what happened. Sharon initially made it across, set up the pontoon bridges. Then Adon followed, and he turned south, and he began to blast away at the Egyptian army to the south. And then Magan came in, and he began to tear up the supply lines. And Cairo was just 40 miles away. And they managed to penetrate 25 of those 40 miles. So that's Operation Gazelle, a really important part of the Israeli victory. In the last analysis, page 214. In the last analysis, the Israeli armed force had won the most striking victory in their history. It's worth recalling that the combined Arab forces actually had launched their offensive with more troops and weapons than those available to NATO. That's our North Atlantic Treaty Organization, our allies in Europe. And this was against a small country with a population unready and an army unmobilized. Despite the fury of the war, the surprise attack on two fronts, the incomparable advantages of Arab manpower and military equipment, Israel had held out, and eventually its forces had penetrated well beyond the enemy's borders. So God is in charge, isn't he, you guys? Whether it be the north or the south. The Egyptians suffered 7,700 combat dead, the Syrians 3,500. The Israelis held now 9,000 POWs, of which 8,000 were Egyptian. The combined Arab forces had lost some 2,000 tanks, over 500 planes, compared to Israel's loss of 804 tanks and 114 planes. Israel lost 2,552 dead and over 3,000 wounded in the 18 days of fighting. It's very disappointing, however, that strategically little was accomplished. Both sides eventually withdrew to approximately the same lines that existed before the war. All right, so you have on page 215 a summary map of the October War, October 6 through 24, 1973. And that will give you an overview of the forces involved and exactly how the war went. So you can review that on page 215. All right, let's move on then. And top of page 216, Ben-Gurion dies. In November, 87-year-old David Ben-Gurion was stricken with a cerebral hemorrhage at his desert kibbutz, Sadeh Boker. He was rushed to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. After lingering 2.5 weeks, he died December 1st, 1973. And if you go to Sadeh Boker today, you can see the very simple memorial to David Ben-Gurion and his wife. This is where they are buried, in the kibbutz that he loved so much, in the Negev that he loved so much. Very simple.
The rocks
are a Jewish tradition that when you visit a grave, instead of leaving flowers or something like that that decays and blows away, you leave a rock because a rock is more permanent. So to place a rock on a grave is just a memorial that someone was here, somebody cared. And so you notice all around the graves, they've provided gravel rocks for people to use there. Excuse me?
His is bigger.
No, they're both exactly the same size. His is the one on the right. It says David Ben-Gurion on the right. So yeah, it's just the angle there. So it's a very simple memorial to a man who was very, very important in the life of the modern state. All right, 1975, UN Resolution 3379, Zionism is racism. In early July 1975, the UN International Women's Year Conference in Mexico City issued a declaration sponsored by 77 non-aligned countries calling for the elimination of Zionism as one of the world's great evils, along with colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialism, foreign domination and occupation, apartheid, and racial discrimination. And the Third World Offensive had only begun. If the Arabs and their supporters failed in the summer of 1975 to evict Israel from the United Nations, they accomplished essentially the same objective, that of isolating Israel diplomatically. November 10, 1975, barely 28 years after voting to establish the Jewish state, the UN General Assembly endorsed a resolution describing Israel as a racist regime in occupied Palestine and stigmatizing Zionism as a form of racialism and racial discrimination. You guys, this is hypocrisy to the max. You know, it's fine to have Arab states, fine to allow Arab states to come into the UN, fine to form Arab states, but not a Jewish state. Isn't that hypocrisy? Definitely. The resolution's preamble additionally singled out Zionism as a threat to world peace and security. And of course, that idea is still gaining momentum today. I've seen signs that demonstrators have raised up saying, you know, Israel is the source of, removing Israel is the source of world peace, things like that. And of course, this whole attitude will find its apex in the book of Zechariah, where all nations come against Jerusalem in the tribulation period. So it's starting now, and it's slowly gaining credence around the world. Israel is a threat to world peace and security. The U.S. stridently opposed this infamous act, but the resolution was approved by a vote of 72-35 with 32 abstentions. On December 5th, the Assembly went so far as to order Israel to return all occupied Arab land without qualification, that is, without qualification of peace treaties, and to restore the legitimate rights of the Palestinians. Sounds like a propaganda ploy to me. In the 1980s, Israel experienced a steady improvement in international standing. At the Madrid Peace Conference, as the Madrid Peace Conference approached, Israel conditioned UN participation in the peace process on the revocation of General Assembly Resolution 3379, Zionism is racism, and this was done December 16, 1991. All right. The bottom of page 216, we come to Likud comes to power, but before we go into that, next week we'll look at Part 4 of Israel, A Nation is Born. It'll cover the time frame from 1967 to 1973. Again, this is the perspective of Foreign Minister Abba Iban. So bring your popcorn next week and be prepared to enjoy this 55-minute or so DVD. So that's where we'll go next week. And then we'll pick up the class in September after this video. So let me go ahead and pray. Then we'll turn you loose, and I'll let you go for tonight. Father again, I want to thank you as we see your hand preserving Israel. There is no human reason why Israel should have survived the 1973 war. The surprise, the massive forces arrayed against her, her lack of preparedness, she should have been wiped off the map. But you intervened and you kept her going. And we'll see more of that as we look at this video next week. So again, thank you for this reminder that you are in charge both of the big and the small. As you are in charge of nations and kings, you are also in charge of our life. And so help us to always trust you no matter what earthquake, what surprise hits us from the north or from the south. We can trust you to see us through. And we thank you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you guys next week.